sacrificial. It can be done without use of fossil fuel. We are burning a million years of post-nuclear in a day. I can see it in the comments that name is one of the least beloved radio stations. We use a plant then. Because it is in France, in France, it's going to be called a tube. What can be done with it? Talk to us about what can be done about fiber.
Flower with pudding, and it got an extra in the hood, so the bee is pressed against the filament and gets just a little colder when it is right inside like this. And then the bee goes on and takes the pollen through another Brazilian tree. And if you didn't do that, you would not get Brazilian. But here is the same bee, and you can see it's a different flower in here. This is in an orchid, a Scandinavian orchid. And this is a male bee, and it is gathering the scent of the orchid so that it can use the perfume of the orchid to attract the female bees for mating to take place. Now, what does that mean? It means that to get the most ecological crop in the Amazon, the major non-timber forest crop of the Amazon, you need a bee, but you also need those epiphytic orchids up in the crown of the forest. But then, who plants the nuts? It's this animal, the agouti, that is the only one that can gnaw open that hard outer shell. It takes some of the nuts and buries them, called scatter hoarding, and puts those somewhere a few hundred meters from the tree, and that's planting the new Brazil. So we need a bee, an orchid, and an agouti to maintain a very important crop in the Amazon. Biodiversity is all about these sorts of interactions. And so that is one of the other very important aspects of it. And there are many other examples. This is another member of the Brazil family, and you can see exactly the same sort of relationship. A smaller bee, and on the top right-hand side, going into the flower of this tree called Protochopera, and in the lower side, the same species of bee gathering its perfume from a Sobralia orchid. So there are many different interactions, and I had the privilege of being able to study many of these sort of things in the Amazon. Now, why is biodiversity so important? Well, maybe one of the important is a selfish one for us humans, and that is that we really do depend on biodiversity in so many ways. First of all, and the one we forget, is environmental service. The air we breathe, the influence it has on climate, is this topic of biodiversity so intimately linked to what we heard from the last week. Then, of course, the ones that we do know more about, the food, medicine, and shelter. So biodiversity is extremely important. The major crops that we grow depend very much on the wild relatives that are out there to maintain their viability. Sometimes a new disease that attacks something like corn. And then where do they go to find resistance to that disease? To the wild species. We would not have had the capacity of something like the Green Revolution if there hadn't been wild species of rats out there. And those are the things that are most threatened. Some of the farms around the world were accumulated over years, various land rats, with different genetic material. And that's where the genetic of biodiversity is so important in this diversity we have, that the wild species have genetic material which the crop species don't. Then medicine. This is a book about the medicinal class of the northwestern Amazon by the father of contemporary ethnobotany, Richard Evans Schultes. And this lists 2,000 species of plants used in that one part of the Amazon. And about 50% of the prescription drugs we use today originated in plants, and many of them still have plant material in them. And new medicines are being discovered all the time from plants, marine animals, from a lot of biodiversity. Then shelter, of course, is the other very important part of it. whether it's a modern house or an Indian dwelling. Now, perhaps the greatest challenge to biodiversity today is what we're doing with it, by destroying those habitats, the huge areas of deforestation in Indonesia, Malaya, Brazil, but not just in those countries. In most countries, their habitats being destroyed, wetlands being drained in the UK, for example. Here is a very nice habitat, the cloud forests of Costa Rica. Cloud forests are kept nice and dry, as though they're nice and wet, because of the constant clouds. And I have the privilege of having a PhD student working in this particular cloud forest, Monteverde, in Costa Rica. And she was working on the pollination of plants there. And she phoned me, and I said, "You work in the botanical garden, it's mice." And I knew what she meant, it was mice that were pollinating her plants. And so I went down to have a look with her. So I was out in the forest at night with her, and we were there at the time of the emergence of the golden toad. We were all amongst the tree roots, a beautiful, tiny little toad. And I just loved that animal. I went back on holiday, possibly for some years ago, with my wife, and we asked about the golden toad, and they said it is extinct. Those of you in the front may be able to read what it says down here. A dry climate killed the golden toad of Costa Rica. There we see the link with John Horton. What has happened is that this area was always with a cloud throughout the year, whether it was the rainy season or not. But now it is a real dry season, and that caused this animal that depends on that dam to go extinct. And it only occurs there, so it's extinct in the world. But worse, there are four species of frogs in Amphibian that are extinct in Monteverde because of the small 2 month dry season. Biodiversity is so sensitive to these changes in climate. And so our two thoughts are intimately linked. I am really speaking a great deal about climate change because I see its effect on biodiversity around the world. Well, like the climate change people in the IPCC, that Ron chaired so long and so successfully, the biologists come together and this is the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And that involved 1,400 biologists from 72 countries around the world who were authors of it. I had the privilege of contributing a little about useful plants. And I just want to briefly show you slides of the four main findings of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And like the IPCC system, they are alarming. And over the past 50 years, humans have changed ecosystems more rapidly, we know that. And why? Largely to meet growing demands for food, fresh water, timber, fiber, and fuel. And this has resulted in a substantially and largely irreversible loss of the diversity of life on Earth. The second main finding, these changes have made ecosystems, these changes have had net gains to humans. But these gains have been achieved at growing costs in the form of the degradation of many ecosystem services, increased risks of non-linear changes, and the exacerbation of poverty for some groups of people. So we see that just like the graph we saw is using fossil fuels, that the same is happening about biodiversity. The rich are getting richer and increasing their standard of living, and more people are getting poorer, and this is taking away the benefits from biodiversity for our future generations. The third main finding was that the degradation of ecosystem services could grow significantly worse in the first half of this century, and it's a barrier to achieving the Millennium Development Goal. One of the good things about this report was that it was not just out giving all the bad news, it was giving a plan for change, rather like the IPCC is an external report about the climate change. It was making suggestions of what could be done, and those were called the Millennium Development Goals. And the fourth main finding, the challenge of reversing the degradation of ecosystems, could be partially met under some scenarios that the report outlined, but these involve significant changes in policies, institutions, and practices that are not currently underway. There are many options to conserve or enhance specific ecosystem services in ways that reduce negative trade-offs or that provide positive synergies with other ecosystem services. So it said there are ways, but so far we haven't had sufficient change in our attitude. And maybe that's where we begin to think about what our Christian faith tells us to do. Are we learning from these mistakes that are going on? Wise words from the book of Job. I'm glad that John, that you read from Job to begin today. But ask the animals, and they will teach you, or the birds of the air, and they will tell you, or speak to the earth, and it will teach you, or let the fish of the sea inform. Now, there we have an appeal to biodiversity, and we look at the birds, even the fish. And are we listening to what the Golden Code of Costa Rica has told us? And many other folks in the fishermen, are they the miner's canary that's telling us that there's something wrong? Let's heed those wise words, or as Proverbs said, go to the ant, you lazy bones, consider its ways and be wise. So there we have some pretty direct instructions to listen, to look at nature that is around us. For some reason it's not advancing at the moment. What's the name? Right, whoops, we've now gone far too far. Something. Sorry about this. There we are. Now, the man who really is credited with making biodiversity public as a word is Edward O. Wilson. And that's the cover of one of his books, but his most recent book really has set out a challenge to evangelicals to be leaders of the conservation of biodiversity. Now, Ed Wilson is a very interesting man. He grew up in a very strictly evangelical home in the south of the United States. He became an agnostic and talked about that for many years. But now he feels that there is so much power in the Christian body and so much influence that he needs them on his side. And he doesn't talk now in his book about the ecosystem. He talks about creation. He uses that word. He still confesses to be an agnostic. But he feels that he needs the Christian body on his side. A very interesting challenge. Are we going to accept that? I think this is a great challenge. He even gave statistics about if 1% of the Christians in the US became involved in environmental work, you'd have a whole army working for the environment. So that's a challenge to Christians everywhere, I think. One of the audience here, Sam Berry, wrote a book, God's Book of Works, something that's been a way of looking at God's revelation in creation for many years. And Isaiah chapter 41 says, I'll put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I'll set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and pine together, so that all may know, all may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done it, the Holy One of Israel has created the purpose of biodiversity. God's revelation to us. It's not only in the Bible. It is through this wonderful biodiversity. And so, surely that too is a compelling reason for preserving. Adam's tasks were threefold, really, to rule over biodiversity, but a lot of emphasis has been put on the word dominion. But also, shortly afterwards, he was told to serve and preserve. And so there is that stewardship that we've already heard about in the second chapter of Genesis. And of course, as a plant taxonomist, I like the last part of Adam that he was told to name everything. Well, then we have the real first conserver of biodiversity. People got into real trouble, and so there was pretty drastic action. And so we see that all these animals, a great array of biodiversity, entered into the ark. Noah was told to take every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its time. And then, when the flood subsided, God made a covenant with humans and with biodiversity. We see that there is a covenant not just with Noah. It's not a selfish covenant. Noah was commanded to be fruitful and multiply, just as Adam was. But unlike Adam, he wasn't given the right to have dominion, nor to subdue the earth. God's covenant after the flood was not with Noah, as many people say. Noah was the covenant with Noah. But it was with Noah and his descendants, and with all living creatures. There can be no doubt that about this, because that phrase, with all living creatures, is repeated 8 times in Genesis chapter 9. So, as if to emphasize that this was not just with humankind, but with everything. And it would indicate God's care for every living creature. And so, it would also indicate that we don't have a right to extinguish. In these rather depressing days of the biologist, I encounter ever more species extinction wherever I go in the world. And remembering that there is the Noah's covenant is and that it is everlasting is a great encouragement to my faith. And from time to time, when I see a bright rainbow in the sky, I see it as a signal of hope that the destruction will come to an end one day before all creation is lost. And it's also a sign of the new creation to which we may look forward. In Exodus the other books of the law, we have a lot about good care of biodiversity. One verse or two verses from Exodus chapter 23. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so the poor of your people may eat, and what they eat, the wild animals may eat. You shall do the same with your vineyard and with your olive grove. Now this is another interesting verse because it is thinking of the land. But it also is giving other reasons for leaving the land fallow. so that the poor may eat, and so that the wild animals may eat. So again, we see this God's concern, not just for human beings, but for other parts of his creation. And interestingly enough, if you go to some native groups, they, such as the Aymara Indians in Bolivia, they have a wonderful agricultural system, and they meet as a group to decide who will plant what. And one year they will probably plant canola like this, another year amaranth, another year potatoes. But some families will be told not to plant anything. Do those families go starving? They certainly don't, because other people give the first fruits of their hearts. And they are behaving in a biblical way. Now, there are two places in the Bible that are particularly biodiverse. Job chapter 38-41 and Psalm 104. And so I have put up on the screen now some of the different organisms that are mentioned in those two places. It seems that when God replied to Job out of the whirlwind, that the plenitude of species brought pleasure to God, and it's nowhere more apparent than in these three chapters of the book of Job and in Psalm 104 that harks back to Genesis chapter 1. The wonderful array of biodiversity that is seen in life is quite interesting. After the vain work of his comforters, God speaks to Job, and he doesn't speak about repentance. He speaks about the wonders and his joy in his creation, and mentions all his organs. It seems that one of the purposes of approaching Job in this way was to show him that humans, although created in the image of God, are not the center of all things. What is man in comparison to the strength of Behemoth or Leviathan? These chapters are also full of natural history. They're not just a list of these animals. They talk about the burning of deer, the salt flat habitat of the wild donkey, the nesting habitat of the ostrich, the soaring and nesting of the eagle, and the grass that feeds the hippopotamus. We also see that predator-prey relations are part of God's plan. It's written about the eagle, for example, and he dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is his stronghold. From there he seeks out his food, and his eyes protect it from afar. His young ones feast on blood, and where the slayer is, there he is. Now, because of that habitat comment there, those translated eagle, it might be a vulture, I think, that it's been referred to. Nevertheless, it's all about the habit and predator-prey relations. So Job is humbled to repentance by this array of a wonderful biodiversity of environment. And it's not by human strength. It's by what God says about his creation. It's about the contact with God's creation. And then, later in Psalm 104, we have another wonderful array of biodiversity. Now let's think about Christ and biodiversity. He refers to it many times, and here are just a few well-known texts from Matthew. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? One that makes us think about the link between God and non-human creatures. Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns. And yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth more than they? It's an interesting comment, because it does show the worth of the person created in the image of God. But it also shows God's care for the birds of the air. And of course, I put a plant for him. Observe the lilies of the field, how they grow. They do not toil, nor do they sit. Yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory did not clothe himself like one of these. A wonderful opinion of the lilies of the field, a wonderful flower to arise. And then Jesus spoke in his parables a great deal about and used as illustration various aspects of biodiversity. The parable of the sower, for example, talks a great deal about the process of sowing and the process of germination, when something will germinate on good soil, and what happens when it falls on stone and rocky ground. Now, in Matthew's Gospel alone, Jesus introduces animals on 27 separate occasions. And you are seeing at the moment a gradual list of the animals that were introduced by Jesus in Matthew's Gospel. And again, we see quite an array of wild organisms and domestic organisms that are coming up here. And it's not surprising that someone who has spent 40 days in the wilderness, someone who was taken as a small child to a far country, to Egypt, and someone who grew up in a rural area, learned a great deal about the animals and the plants around him. So it's no surprise that Jesus is referring to biodiversity in many different places, right to the end, where you see the last one on that is the cockerel. In other words, talking to Peter, just at the end of his life. Then, the last thing I want to say about why we should be, as Christians, conserving biodiversity is because of Jesus' role in creation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything that was made. Very familiar verses at the beginning of John's Gospel. But note Jesus' role in creation. And if we don't see it there, then look at Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15. He, that's Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. But in him, all things in heaven and on earth were created, invisible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. So what we see in Jesus' role in creation is surely one of the prime reasons, the prime reasons, why we should be taking care of his creation if we truly believe in our Lord Jesus Christ. John Horton showed very clearly how developed countries have caused the changes in climate to green lifestyle. And he linked it as a moral imperative for us to do something about the poorer countries. And so it is a Christian responsibility to do something about biodiversity. This is climate change. We can't go on living the climate change, the biodiversity crisis, because of something like this, where 83% of the world's wealth is controlled by 20% of the population. The lowest 20% of the world's population control only 1.4% and live on less than a dollar a day. And the second 20% only control 1.9%. Now, can that be a Christian world? It is not. Yet, surely our Christian principles tell us that we need to address this. Both the problem of climate change and biodiversity will only truly be addressed if we look at the problems of justice in the world. And I think that that's where we as Christians, and Christian scientists too, particularly come in. A soybean field near Santarém in Brazil, right near the Amazon. And this built, stimulated by big company Cargill, who are interested in exploiting this and selling the soy to Europe and to Asia. And so they began to cut down the Amazon rainforest. And here in the soybean field, in that same soybean field, is a Catholic priest. This man defended the farmers, small farmers who lived on this property before they were evicted by the development. And he has had his life threatened four times, twice people coming with guns to his house. But fortunately, at those points, he wasn't there. And there are many martyrs who defended both the forest against the timber barons in the Amazon and against the development of soil. But what is this for? It is for to feed the cattle of Europe. When BSC was the crisis here, they changed the there was a necessity to change the way that our cattle were fed. And so then Britain and Europe started importing soy and Brazil, again feeding our Britain. And so we see what is happening as a result of this. Are we obeying our Christian principles? John already gave a few verses to appeal to us from the point of view of justice and moral terms. But whosoever in the world is and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Or from Proverbs, he who oppresses the poor reproaches his maker, but he who is gracious to the needy honors him. Those are important texts. And we're not doing that right now with what we're doing to biodiversity, with what we're doing to the planet. And I think this is the real challenge that is before us today, to put our faith in action. Thank you.
Economists and another group who calls themselves conservation biologists. has to do with picking up a dam to save the salmon runs. And the issue, the position that the Natural Resource Economists hold is that there's no scientifically observable genetic difference between native salmon, that are cream run wild salmon, and hatchery salmon that are trucked around the dam, and therefore there's no reason to try to preserve these native species at great cost. What's the truth?
I am not an ichthyologist, so I could excuse myself on that way. But I am quite sure that the cultivated ones have less genetic diversity than there is out there in all those wild species of salmon around the world. And I think that the conservationists have got a very good cause, and probably there is inbreeding within the cultivated ones. Plus, the other thing on that is all the substances they use in producing those over the wild ones too. We have the same problem with fish farming in this country, and the antibiotics and things that they use. So, not unique to the Pacific West of your country, but we need that genetic, wild genetic diversity to that.
Step to that last one, I see beautiful clear bay. And you can learn more overfeeding fish and fish farms.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I just wondered if you felt that the Bible offered us many resources for tackling the ethic issues around the way the needs of the human population actually clash with the biodiversity. I can see the value of biodiversity, but with population pressure from some part of the world and needs to make more agricultural animals, land and housing, there are noticeably going to be conflicts of interest between biodiversity and between the human population. Do you feel there are resources within the technical and the global situation?
Well, I think we need to, first of all, look at the greediness of the way we are living now. And the Bible certainly has a great deal to say about the plight of the poor and our need to help. And a great deal to say about wealth and the potential of misusing wealth. And there is no doubt that that's where we are today. And so I think the Bible has a great deal to say about this. Yes, some of the things you say are necessary, but many of the things are sheer greed. And it is that aspect that is causing most of the serious changes, both in loss of biodiversity and climate.
And that is in terms of what we talk immediately after.
My question is about GM, and the impact on biodiversity. But to relate a bit to your comments, can we even forget GM that is biodiversity friendly? Can be handled in the world today because there are so many elements of
I am very sorry that I have the wrong chairman here. If it had been Donald Bruce here, one of the best books on GM is the one he put together for the Church of Scotland. It is an issue. One could give another whole talk on it. GM is a technique that can be used for the good, to treat the world. You can grow plants on marginal habitats, put in fault tolerance and things. The real problem with it is that it's been taken up in a greedy way again, exactly the same. It's been to make the shareholders of certain companies richer and not for humanitarian reason. So they're interested in making a resistance to a particular herbicide, and then they can create, and they control the, they buy up the chemical factories as well to do the grain. This sort of thing. Now this is sheer greed that is driving genetic engineering, yet it is a technique given to us that can be useful. So I would be certainly opposed to saying it is all wrong. I can see all sorts of ways in which we can use it to address some of the problems, but on the whole, that's not what's being done at present. And we need to be strong voices about that.
I think
we're agreeing, aren't we, that in terms of that GDP, that 20% of the world it's a means of exploitation, whether it's in crops, or whether it's in pharmaceuticals, or whether it's in emission technology. And we ought to be trying to go global justice on that.
Exactly, yes.
Thank you. I was very moved by the story of the golden pear. I wanted to ask you, if supposedly cause of the extinction had not been human activity, but had been natural pressures within that ecosystem, would you still have had a responsibility to save the golden pear?
Well, that's a very interesting philosophical question. Extinction is a natural process, and so we have to acknowledge that. At the moment, the extinction rate is reckoned to be at least 1,000 times greater than the natural rate. And so I would say that so much of the extinction going on today is not natural at all. My personal opinion would be if it was a natural happening that is part of it, then maybe we should just let creation go the way God wants it to go, and not maybe.
That seems a very good topic to discuss. So thank you very much, and lovely talk. And happy to see you.